stopped again. "But," added the pilot, "maybe we can come to some other arrangement."
Fix held his breath.
"How?" asked Phileas Fogg. "By going to Nagasaki in the far south of Japan, 1,100 miles away, or to Shanghai, which is 800 miles from Hong Kong. If we went the second way, we could stay close to the Chinese coast, which would be a considerable advantage, especially as the currents run north."
"Pilot," said Phileas Fogg, "it's from Yokohama, not Shanghai or Nagasaki, that I've got to catch the American mailboat."
"Why?" replied the pilot. "The steamer for San Francisco doesn't start from Yokohama. It puts in at Yokohama and Nagasaki, but its home port is Shanghai."
"Are you sure what you're saying is correct?"
"Yes, I am."
"So, when does the steamer leave Shanghai?"
"On the 11th at 7 in the morning. So we've got 4 days ahead of us. 4 days makes 96 hours, and at an average rate of 8 knots, if all goes well, with the wind staying in the southwest and a calm sea, we can cover the 800 miles between here and Shanghai."
"When could you set sail?"
"In an hour. The time it takes to get provisions on board and the ship under sail."
"Consider it a deal. Are you the skipper of this boat?"
"Yes, John Bunsby, the skipper of the Tankadera."
"Do you want a deposit?"
"If you would be so kind, Your Honour."
"Here's an advance of £200. Sir," he added, turning towards Fix, "if you would like to avail yourself of the opportunity—"
"Sir,"
Fix replied without flinching,
"I was about to ask you this favour."
"Good. In half an hour we'll be on board."
"But the poor fellow," said Mrs. Ayuda, who was very concerned about Passepartout's disappearance.
"I shall do all I can for him," replied Phileas Fogg.
And so, while Fix went towards the pilot boat in a jittery, feverish, and furious state, the other two headed for the main police station in Hong Kong. When they got there, Phileas Fogg gave a description of Passepartout and left enough money to cover the cost of his repatriation. He went through the same formalities at the French consulate, and then the palanquin took the travellers back to the outer harbour after previously stopping at the hotel to pick up the luggage. 3 o'clock struck. The pilot boat number 43, with its crew on board and supplies loaded, was ready to set sail. The Tankadera was an attractive little schooner of 20 tons, long in the beam, with fine bows and elegant lines. It looked like a racing yacht. Its shiny brass fittings, its galvanized iron features, and its spotless white deck showed that skipper John Bunsby was determined to look after it properly. Its two masts leaned slightly backwards. It carried a spanker, a mizzen, a forestay, a jib, and topsails, and was rigged to take full advantage of a following wind. It clearly had an excellent turn of speed, and it had in fact won several prizes in pilot boat competitions. The crew of the Tankadera consisted of John Bunsby and 4 seamen. They were the sort of fearless sailors ready to go out whatever the weather to bring ships into port, and were very familiar with the conditions. John Bunsby was a man of about 45, sturdy, weather-beaten, keen-eyed, energetic-looking, steady as a rock, and in full control of the situation. He could inspire confidence in the most timid of people. Phileas Fogg and Mrs. Ayuda went on board. Fix was already there. The rear hatch of the schooner led down into a square cabin containing bunks recessed into the walls and a round-shaped sofa. In the middle stood a table lit by a hurricane lamp. The accommodation was small but clean.
"I'm sorry I have nothing better to offer you," said Mr. Fogg to Fix, who bowed without making any reply.
The police inspector felt a sort of humiliation at being the recipient of this fellow Fogg's kindness like this.
"One thing's sure," he thought. "He's a very polite crook, but he's a crook all the same."
At 3:10 the sails were hoisted. The Union Jack was flying from the schooner's gaff. The passengers were sitting out on deck. Mr. Fogg and Mrs. Ayuda gave a last look at the quayside in case Passepartout had reappeared. Fix was feeling somewhat apprehensive because there was still a chance that the unfortunate chap he had treated so shabbily might show up and that would have led to an argument in which Fix would have been the likely loser. But the Frenchman did not turn up, and doubtless the overpowering effects of the drug had still not worn off. At last the skipper reached the open sea, and, as it caught the wind in its spanker, foresail and jibs, the Tankadera leapt forward over the waves. Chapter 21, where the skipper of the Tankadera is in serious danger of losing a 200-pound bonus. To attempt an 800-mile voyage on a vessel weighing 20 tons was a hazardous undertaking, and particularly at that time of year. The China seas are generally rough and subject to frequent heavy squalls, especially at the time of the equinoxes, when it was still early November. It would obviously have been to the pilot's advantage to take his passengers as far as Yokohama, because he was being paid by the day. But it would have been reckless of him to attempt such a crossing in the prevailing conditions, and even going up to Shanghai was already a bold, not to say foolhardy, thing to do. However, John Bunsby had every faith in his Tankadera, which rose to the waves like a seagull, and perhaps he was right to be confident. As the day came to a close, the Tankadera navigated its way through the treacherous channels around Hong Kong, performing admirably, whatever the setting of the sails, whether going close to the wind or with the wind behind it.
"It goes without saying, Captain," said Phileas Fogg, just as the schooner was heading for the open sea, "that time is of the essence." "Your Honor may rely on me," replied John Bunsby. "As far as the sails are concerned, we put out everything the wind will allow. Our topsails wouldn't be any help at all. They would only slow us down."
"You're the expert, Captain, not me. And I have every trust in you."
Phileas Fogg, his back straight, his legs apart, and firm on his feet like a seasoned sailor, looked unflinchingly out at the stormy sea. The young woman who was sitting at the stern felt moved as, in the gathering dusk, she gazed out over this dark ocean that she was braving on such a frail craft. Above her head spread the sails that carried it through space as if they were great wings. The schooner, lifted up by the wind, seemed to be flying through the air. Night came. The moon was entering its first quarter, and its faint light would soon be extinguished by the mist on the horizon. Clouds were blowing in from the east and were already filling part of the sky. The captain had set up his navigation lights, a necessary precaution in these busy waters where vessels were making for port. Collisions between ships were quite common, and at the speed the schooner was travelling it would have broken up on the slightest impact. Fix was daydreaming at the fore of the vessel. He kept to himself, since he knew that Fogg was not very talkative by nature. In any case, he strongly disliked talking to this man whose help he had accepted. He was also thinking about the future. It seemed certain to him that Fogg would not stop in Yokohama and that he would immediately catch the steamer for San Francisco in order to get to America, whose vastness would ensure that he was safe and beyond the reach of the law. Phileas Fogg's plan seemed to him to be perfectly straightforward. Instead of leaving England for the United States like any ordinary criminal, this man Fogg had gone the long way round and crossed three quarters of the globe in order to have a better chance of getting to America, where he would quietly get through all the bank's money once the police were off his trail. But what would Fix do once he was in the United States? Would he give up on his man? No way. Until he received the extradition papers, he wouldn't let Fogg out of his sight. It was his duty, and he would see things through to the bitter end. In any case, one thing had worked in his favour. Passepartout was no longer there to help his master, and, above all, after the secrets Fix had already given away, it was vital that master and servant should not see each other ever again. Phileas Fogg was also thinking about his servant, who had disappeared in such mysterious circumstances. All things considered, he thought it still quite possible that, as a result of some misunderstanding, the poor fellow might have got on board the Carnatic at the last minute. Mrs. Ayuda was of the same opinion, and she greatly missed this trusty servant, to whom she owed so much. It was possible, therefore, that they might meet up with him again in Yokohama, and it would be easy to find out if he had got there on the Carnatic. At about 10 o'clock, the wind began to freshen. It would have perhaps been safer to reef the sails, but the captain, after carefully considering the look of the sky, decided to leave them as they were. In any case, the Tankadero was a very stable vessel with a good draft, and the sails could be taken down quickly in the event of a squall. At midnight, Phileas Fogg and Mrs. Aouda went down to the cabin. Fix had got there before them and was stretched out on one of the bunks. As for the captain and his men, they stayed out on deck all night. By sunrise the following morning, 8th of November, the schooner had done more than 100 miles. The log, which was frequently dropped into the water, showed that the average speed was between 8 and 9 knots. The Tankadera had slack in its sails, which were all out, and with this setting it could reach its maximum speed. If the wind held, all would be well. For the whole of that day the Tankadera stayed close to the coast where the currents were favourable. The coast was no more than 5 miles away on the port quarter, and its irregular outline could sometimes be seen through breaks in the fog. As the wind was coming from the land, the sea was less rough for that very reason. This was fortunate for the schooner because vessels of low tonnage are particularly affected by the swell, which cuts down their speed, or, to use a nautical term, kills them. Around midday the wind slackened a little and shifted southeast. The pilot put up the topsails, but 2 hours later he had to bring them down because the wind was freshening again. Mr. Fogg and the young woman, who, very fortunately, were not susceptible to seasickness, had a healthy appetite for the rations aboard. Fix was invited to share their meal and had to accept, well aware that his stomach, like a boat, needed some form of ballast, but he found it galling. He felt it somehow disloyal to be travelling at this man's expense and to eat his provisions. Nevertheless, eat is what he did, even if it was really more of a snack than a meal. When they'd finished eating, however, he thought it necessary to take this man Fogg to one side and say to him, "Sir." This "sir" really stuck in his gullet, and he had to restrain himself not to take this "sir" by the scruff of the neck.
"Sir, you have been so kind as to offer me a place on board, but although my means are much more modest than your own, I do intend to pay my way."
"Don't mention it, sir," replied Mr. Fogg.
"But I insist."
"No, sir," repeated Fogg, in a tone of voice that allowed no further discussion. "It comes under the running costs." Fix bowed. He could hardly breathe, and so he went to lie down at the fore of the schooner, and didn't say a word for the rest of the evening. Meanwhile, the boat was making rapid progress. John Bunsby was feeling very optimistic. Several times he said to Mr. Fogg that they would arrive in good time. Mr. Fogg merely replied that that was what he expected. In any case, the whole crew of the little schooner were doing their utmost. The prospect of a bonus spurred these good fellows on, and so every single rope was carefully tightened, every sail was vigorously hoisted taut, and the helmsman was careful to ensure the vessel did not veer off course. The standard of sailing couldn't have been any higher in a Royal Yacht Club regatta. By the evening, the pilot could tell from the log that they had covered 220 miles since Hong Kong, and Phileas Fogg had grounds for hoping that when he arrived in Yokohama, he would still be on schedule. If this proved to be the case, the first serious setback he had encountered since leaving London would probably not have any harmful effect. During the night, towards the early hours of the morning, the Tankadero was well on its way through the Fukien Strait, which separates the large island of Formosa from the mainland of China, and it was now crossing the Tropic of Cancer. The sea was very difficult in this strait, which was full of eddies formed by different currents meeting. The schooner laboured a lot. The choppy waves slowed down its progress. It became almost impossible to stand up on deck. At daybreak the wind freshened further. The sky gave signs of a gale coming. In addition, the barometer showed that a change of atmospheric pressure was in the offing. Its daytime readings were irregular, and the mercury oscillated unpredictably. Towards the southeast they could see a heavy swell developing, which suggested that a storm was brewing. The previous evening the sun had set against a red mist, in an ocean glowing like fire. The captain spent a long time examining the lowering sky and mumbling unintelligibly to himself. A little later, finding himself next to his passenger, he whispered to him,
"Can I tell your honour the truth?"
"Of course," replied Phileas Fogg.
Well, we're in for a storm.
Is it coming from the north or the south? Was all Mr. Fogg wanted to know.
From the south, look, there's a typhoon on the way.
I don't mind about a typhoon if it's from the south. It'll help us on our way, replied Mr. Fogg.
If that's how you take it, then it's fine by me, retorted the captain.
John Bunsby's predictions proved only too accurate. At an earlier time of year, the typhoon would, in the words of a famous meteorologist, have spent itself in a spectacular electrical display, but now at the winter equinox, it was likely that it would turn out to be extremely violent. The captain took every advance precaution. He had all the schooner's sails furled and the yards brought down on deck. The topmasts were struck and the boom taken in. The hatches were securely battened down so that not a drop of water could get into the vessel's hull. A singular triangular sail, a storm jib of strong canvas, was hoisted as a foretop staysail to enable the schooner to stay stern to the wind. Then all they could do was wait. John Bunsby had urged the passengers to go down into the cabin, but to be cooped up in such a confined space with hardly any air and shaken about by the swell was not a very appealing prospect. Neither Mr. Fogg nor Mrs. Ayuda nor even Mr. Fix agreed to leave the deck. Towards 8 o'clock a squall of rain and gusting wind hit the ship. Even with the small amount of sail it had out, the Tankadero was tossed about like a feather in this indescribably strong wind. To say that it was 4 times the speed of a locomotive going at full steam would be an understatement. So for the whole of that day the vessel headed north, swept along by the monstrous waves, but fortunately going at the same speed as them. Many times it was almost engulfed by one of these mountains of water that reared up behind it, but the captain's deft touch at the helm prevented disaster. The passengers were sometimes soaked by spray, but reacted stoically. Fix was grumbling away, it was true, but the intrepid Mrs. Ayuda kept her eyes firmly fixed on her companion, whose composure she couldn't help admiring, and proved herself worthy of him as she stood by his side to face the storm. As for Phileas Fogg himself, he made it look as if the typhoon had been part of his plan. Up until then the Tankadera had been sailing north, but towards evening, as was to be feared, the wind veered 3/4 and blew instead from the northwest. The schooner, now broadsides on to the waves, was severely tossed around. The waves struck with a violence that would have been terrifying for anyone who did not realize how securely the different parts of a boat are put together. As night came, the storm grew even stronger. Seeing the darkness descend, and with it the gale increase, John Bunsby became extremely worried. He wondered if the time had come to put into port, and consulted his crew. After consulting them, John Bunsby went up to Phileas Fogg and said to him,
"Your Honour, I think it would be advisable to put in at one of the ports along the coast."
"I think so too," replied Phileas Fogg.
"Right,"
said the captain.
"But which one?"
"I only know of one," Mr. Fogg answered calmly.
"And that one is?"
"Shanghai." For a few moments the captain did not understand what this reply meant, the obstinacy and tenacity it contained. Then he exclaimed,
"Well, then, yes, Your Honour is right. Shanghai it is."
So the Tankadera stayed determinedly on course to the north. It was a truly terrifying night. It was a miracle that the little schooner didn't capsize. Twice it was swamped by the waves, and everything would have been swept overboard if the lashings hadn't held. Mrs. Ayuda was exhausted, but she didn't make the slightest complaint. On more than one occasion, Mr. Fogg had to rush towards her to protect her from the violence of the waves. Daylight returned. The storm was still raging fiercely. However, the wind fell back to the southeast. This improved things, and the Tankadera could again make headway over this stormy sea, whose waves came up against those produced by the new direction of the wind. The resulting clash of opposing swells would have crushed a less sturdily built vessel. From time to time they could glimpse the coastline through breaks in the mist, but there wasn't a ship in sight. The Tankadera was the only one out at sea. By midday there were signs that it was becoming calm again, and as the sun went down, these signs became clearer. The storm was short-lived because of its very intensity. The passengers, who were by now absolutely exhausted, were able to eat a little and have some rest. The night was relatively peaceful. The captain was able to unfurl his sails partially. The vessel was travelling at considerable speed. By dawn of the following day, 11th of November, John Bunsby could tell from looking at the coastline that they were about 100 miles from Shanghai. There were 100 miles to go and only one day left. Mr. Fogg had to be in Shanghai by that very evening if he was to catch the steamer leaving for Yokohama. Without the storm which had made him lose several hours, he wouldn't still have been 30 miles from the port. The wind slackened noticeably, but fortunately the sea fell at the same time. The schooner unfurled all its sails. The topsails, staysails, and foretop staysails were all out, and the sea was foaming beneath the stem of the ship. By midday the Tankadera was only about 45 miles from Shanghai. It had 6 hours left to reach the port before the steamer for Yokohama departed. There was great anxiety on board. They wanted to arrive at all costs. All of them, with the exception of Phileas Fogg, felt their hearts pounding with impatience. The little schooner needed to keep up its rate of 9 knots, but the wind kept on slackening. The breeze blew fitfully, with unpredictable gusts coming off the coast. Once they had passed, the sea immediately became calm. However, the vessel was very light, and its tall sails, made from very fine cloth, captured the wayward breezes so well that, with the help of the current, John Bunsby calculated that it was only 10 miles to the Shanghai River, though the town itself is situated at least 12 miles above the mouth. By 7 o'clock they were still 3 miles from Shanghai. The captain let out a crude expletive. He was bound to forfeit the £200 bonus. He looked at Mr. Fogg. Mr. Fogg was impassive, and yet his whole fortune was at stake at that very moment. At that moment also, a long, black, tapering shape, accompanied by a plume of smoke, appeared on the waterline. It was the American steamer, which was leaving on schedule.
"Damn it!"
exclaimed John Bunsby, pushing away the helm in a gesture of despair.
"Send a signal," was all Phileas Fogg said.
A small brass cannon was lying on the foredeck of the Tankadera. Its purpose was to send signals when visibility was poor. So the cannon was loaded to the muzzle, but just when the captain was going to fire it, Mr. Fogg said, "Put the flag at half-mast." The flag was duly lowered. It was a distress signal, and it was to be hoped that on seeing it, the American steamer would change course momentarily and make towards the vessel.
"Fire!" said Mr. Fogg,
and a blast from the small brass cannon rang out. Chapter 22. Where Passepartout comes to realize that, even on the other side of the world, it is sensible to have some money in your pocket. After leaving Hong Kong on the 7th of November at 6:30 in the evening, the Carnatic headed at full steam for Japan. It was carrying a full load of goods and passengers. 2 cabins at the aft remained empty. They were the ones booked in the name of Mr. Phileas Fogg. The next morning, the crew at the fore of the ship were presented with rather a strange sight. A half-dazed passenger, unsteady on his feet and totally dishevelled, who was emerging from the second-class hatchway and staggering across to a pile of spare masts, which he sat down on. This passenger was none other than Passepartout. What had happened was as follows. A few moments after Fix had walked out of the opium den, 2 attendants had picked up Passepartout, who had fallen into a deep sleep, and laid him out on the bed reserved for the smokers. But 3 hours later, Passepartout, haunted even in his nightmares by a single idea, woke up struggling against the stupefying effects of the drug. The thought of a duty unfulfilled roused him from his torpor. He left his bed for addicts and, clinging to the walls, falling then getting up again, but all the time driven by a sort of irresistible impulse, he staggered out of the opium den, shouting as if still in a dream, "The Carnatic! The Carnatic!" The Carnatic was there with its steam up, ready to depart. Passepartout only had a few steps to take. He rushed up the gangway, crossed onto the fore of the ship, and fell down senseless, just as the Carnatic was slipping its moorings. Used as they were to this sort of spectacle, a few of the sailors took the poor fellow down to a second-class cabin, and Passepartout didn't wake up until the following morning, by which time they were 150 miles off the Chinese coast. This, then, is how that morning Passepartout came to on the deck of the Carnatic, filling his lungs with fresh sea breeze. The pure air sobered him up. He tried to collect his thoughts, but it was not easy. Still, in the end, he remembered what had happened the previous evening, the secrets Fix had let him in on, the opium den, etc.
"It's obvious," he said to himself, "that I must have got horribly drunk. What will Mr. Fogg have to say about it? In any case, I didn't miss the boat, and that's the main thing."
Then, with Fix in mind, he said to himself,
"Well, I hope that's the last we ever hear of him, and that after the suggestions he made to me, he hasn't had the nerve to follow us on the Carnatic. A police inspector, a detective on the trail of my master, who's accused of robbing the Bank of England. Oh, come off it. If Mr. Fogg's a thief, then I am a murderer."
Should Passepartout tell all this to his master? Was it right to explain to him Fix's role in this business? Wouldn't it be better to wait until they got to London to tell him that an inspector from the Metropolitan Police had trailed him all the way around the world so that they could laugh about it together? Yes, that must be it. In any case, it was something to think about. The most urgent thing was to meet up with Mr. Fogg and present his apologies for his unspeakable behaviour. So Passepartout got up. The sea was rough and the steamer was rolling heavily. The worthy fellow, who was still not very steady on his feet, made his way as best he could to the rear of the ship. On the deck he could see no one resembling either his master or Mrs. Ayuda.
"Good," he said. "Mrs. Ayuda must still be asleep now. Mr. Fogg, for his part, will have found himself a whist partner, and true to form."
With this, Passepartout went into the lounge. Mr. Fogg wasn't there. There was only one thing left for it, to ask the purser which was Mr. Fogg's cabin. The purser replied that there was no passenger of that name.
"Excuse me," said Passepartout, not taking no for an answer. "He's a tall gentleman, standoffish, not very communicative, accompanied by a young lady."
"There isn't a young lady aboard," replied the purser.
"What's more, here is the passenger list. You can look at it for yourself."
Passepartout looked at the list. His master's name wasn't on it. He was completely dazed. Then an idea flashed through his mind.
"Wait a minute. I am on the Carnatic, aren't I?"
he let out. "Yes," replied the purser.
"On the way to Yokohama?"
"Absolutely." For a moment, Passepartout had thought that he was on the wrong ship. But if he really was on the Carnatic, then it was definite that his master wasn't. Passepartout collapsed into an armchair. It was a bolt from the blue. Then, suddenly, in a flash, everything became clear to him. He remembered that the Carnatic's departure had been brought forward, that he was supposed to inform his master, and that he hadn't done so. It was his fault that Mr. Fogg and Mrs. Ayuda were not on the boat. It was his fault, certainly, but even more, it was the fault of that double-crosser who had got him drunk in order to separate him from his master and to keep Mr. Fogg in Hong Kong. At last he understood the police inspector's game. And now his master was without doubt financially ruined. He had lost his bet, been arrested, and perhaps imprisoned. Passepartout was beside himself at the thought of all this. If ever he came across that man Fix again, he really would have a score to settle. In the end, after his initial feeling of dejection, Passepartout recovered his composure and considered the situation. It was certainly not enviable. The Frenchman was on his way to Japan. He would get there all right, but how would he get back? His pockets were empty. He didn't have a shilling, not even a penny. On the other hand, his passage and his food on board had already been paid for. So he had 5 or 6 days to make up his mind about what to do. It would be impossible to describe how much he ate and drank during the crossing. He ate for his master, for Mrs. Ayuda, and for himself. He ate as if Japan, the country he was heading for, was a desert island, totally devoid of anything edible. On the 13th, the Carnatic entered Yokohama Harbor on the morning tide. Yokohama is an important stopping-off point in the Pacific, used by all the steamers that transport mail and passengers between North America, China, Japan, and Malaya. Yokohama is situated in Tokyo Bay, quite close to that enormous town, which is the second capital of the Japanese Empire, and where the shogun used to live in the days when this title of civil emperor existed. Tokyo is also the rival of Kyoto, the great city where the Mikado, the holy emperor descended from the gods, lives. The Carnatic docked in Yokohama, near the jetties of the port and the customs sheds, amid a large number of ships from all over the world. Passepartout set foot in the mysterious land of the rising sun without the slightest enthusiasm. He had nothing better to do than trust his luck and wander around the streets of the city. Passepartout found himself to begin with in a truly European-style city, with houses with low facades, decorated with verandas beneath which spread elegant colonnades. Its streets, squares, docks and wharfs covered the whole area between the treaty promontory and the river. There, as in Hong Kong or Calcutta, was a swarming mass of people of all races, Americans, English, Chinese and Dutch, merchants prepared to buy and sell anything under the sun. Amid all these, the French person would have looked as much of an outsider as if he'd been abandoned among savages. Passepartout had one possible solution, to seek the help of the French or British consulates in Yokohama. However, he was reluctant to tell his story because it was so closely connected to his master's, and before having to resort to this, he wanted to explore all the other options. So, after going through the European quarter without anything positive turning up, he went into the Japanese quarter, determined, if necessary, to carry on as far as Tokyo. This native part of Yokohama is called Benten, after the name of a goddess of the sea worshipped on the neighboring islands. It contained wonderful avenues of fir trees and cedars, sacred doorways with strange architectural forms, bridges hidden amid bamboo and reeds, temples sheltering under the immense and melancholy cover of ancient cedars, monasteries in the depths of which Buddhist priests and the followers of Confucius vegetated. The unending streets were crowded with groups of children with rosy complexions and red cheeks. These youngsters, who looked as if they were cutouts from a Japanese screen, were playing among short-legged poodles and yellowish cats that had no tails and were very lazy and affectionate. The streets were teeming with people, and there was an incessant coming and going. Bonzes going past in procession, monotonously striking their drums and tambourines. Yakunin, customs and police officers, with lacquer-encrusted pointed hats, carrying two sabers in their belts. Soldiers dressed in blue cotton uniforms with white stripes and armed with percussion guns. Men from the Mikado's guard with their tight-fitting silk doublets, chainmail tunics and coats of mail, and many other soldiers of various ranks, because the military profession is as highly regarded in Japan as it is looked down on in China. Then came mendicant friars, pilgrims in long robes, ordinary civilians with sleek jet-black hair, large heads, long torsos and thin legs, short in stature, with complexions varying in color from the darkest shades of copper to dull white, but never as yellow as that of the Chinese, from whom the Japanese differ considerably. Finally, among the carriages, the palanquins, the horses, the porters, the wind-powered wheelbarrows, the norimons with their lacquered sides, the comfortable kangos, proper litters made of bamboo, could be seen some plain-looking women. They walked around taking small steps with their tiny feet, wearing canvas shoes, straw sandals, or elaborately carved wooden clogs. They had slanting eyes, flattened breasts, and blackened teeth, as was the fashion of the day, but they wore with great elegance the national dress, the kimono, a sort of combination of dressing gown and silk sash, with a wide belt that opened out behind into an elaborate bow, a design that modern Parisian women seem to have borrowed from the Japanese. Passepartout spent a few hours walking among this colourful crowd, looking as he went at the strange and expensive-looking shops, the bazaars crammed with flashy items of Japanese jewellery, the eating houses decorated with streamers and banners which he couldn't afford to go into, and the tea houses that serve the hot, sweet-smelling liquid by the cupful, along with sake, an alcoholic drink made from fermenting rice, and the comfortable smoking dens where they smoke a very fine kind of tobacco and not opium, whose use is practically unknown in Japan. Then Passepartout found himself in the countryside, surrounded by immense rice fields. Here, camellias, the size not of shrubs but trees, provided a brilliant display with flowers that showed their fading colours and exuded fading fragrances, and inside bamboo enclosures were cherry trees, plum trees, and apple trees, which the inhabitants grow more for their blossom than their fruit, and which are protected by fierce-looking scarecrows and noisy whirligigs from the beaks of sparrows, pigeons, crows, and other ravenous birds. There was not a single majestic cedar without its great eagle, not a single weeping willow without a heron sheltering in its foliage, balancing melancholically on one leg. Finally, there were everywhere rooks, ducks, sparrowhawks, wild geese, and a large number of the type of crane the Japanese call lordships, which are for them symbols of longevity and happiness. As he wandered around like this, Passepartout noticed some violets growing among the grass.
"Good," he said. "Here's my supper."
But after smelling them, he thought they had no fragrance.
"No luck," he said to himself.
Admittedly, the trusty fellow had taken the precaution of having a hearty meal before leaving the Carnatic, but after a day's walk he felt pretty hungry. He had been quick to notice that there was absolutely no mutton, goat, or pork on the stands of the local butchers, and because he knew that it was against their religion to kill cattle, which were used only for agricultural purposes, he had come to the conclusion that meat was very scarce in Japan. He was quite right about this, but if he couldn't eat butcher's meat, his stomach would have made do quite happily with a joint or two of wild boar or deer, a few partridges or quails, some poultry or fish, which, together with rice, make up the staple diet of the Japanese. However, he had to make the best of things, and so he put off until the next day the question of finding something to eat. Night came. Passepartout returned to the native quarter and wandered about the streets amid the multicoloured lanterns, watching the groups of travelling acrobats perform their amazing tricks, and the outdoor astrologers getting crowds of people to gather around their telescopes. Then he saw the harbour again, sparkling with the lights of fishermen who attracted the fish by the glow of their burning torches. Finally the streets emptied. The crowd gave way to the yakunin on their rounds. These officers, in their magnificent uniforms and surrounded by their retinue, looked like ambassadors, and each time he encountered one of these splendid-looking patrols, Passepartout joked to himself,
"Here we go, another Japanese delegation off to Europe."
Chapter 23, in which Passepartout grows an exceedingly long nose. The following day, an exhausted, starving Passepartout said to himself that he had to have something to eat at all costs, and the sooner the better. He didn't have the option of selling his watch, but he would rather have died of hunger. Now was the ideal opportunity for the dear fellow to use the loud, if not harmonious, voice with which nature had endowed him. He knew a few French and English popular songs, and he made up his mind to try them out. The Japanese must certainly be keen on music, since they did everything to the accompaniment of cymbals, drums, and tambourines, and they were bound to appreciate the talents of a European virtuoso. However, it was perhaps too early in the morning to organize a concert, and the music lovers, if awakened unexpectedly, might not have shown themselves too grateful for the privilege. Passepartout decided, therefore, to wait a few hours. But as he walked around, the thought struck him that he looked too well-dressed for a travelling musician, so he had the idea of exchanging his clothes for a get-up more in keeping with his position. In addition, this exchange would produce a small profit, which he could immediately put to use to satisfy his appetite. Once he had taken this decision, all that remained was for him to put it into practice. After a considerable amount of searching, he eventually found a local second-hand dealer to whom he made his proposal. The second-hand dealer liked the European clothes, and soon Passepartout left the shop wearing old Japanese robes in a sort of ribbed turban, which had faded over time. But in exchange, he had a few silver coins jangling in his pocket.
Good, he thought. I'll just pretend to myself that it's carnival time.
Passepartout's first concern, now that he had been Japanesed, was to go into a modest-looking tea-house, and there he ate chicken leftovers and a few handfuls of rice, like a man who didn't know where his next meal was coming from.
Now,
he said to himself after his hearty meal,
the main thing is to keep a cool head. I no longer have the option of selling this get-up for an even more Japanese-looking one, so I'll have to devise the quickest means I can of getting out of the land of the rising sun, which I won't have very fond memories of.
Passepartout then had the idea of going to see the steamers due to leave for America. He was planning to offer his services as a cook or servant, and wanted in return only his food and passage. Once he'd reached San Francisco, he'd see about sorting out his other problems. The main thing was to get across the 4,700 miles of Pacific Ocean that lay between Japan and the New World. Passepartout was not the type who would let an idea go to waste, and so he headed for Yokohama Harbor. But the closer he got to the docks, the more his plan, which had looked so simple on the spur of the moment, seemed impractical. Why would they need a cook or servant on board an American steamer, and how would anyone trust him in his present get-up? What recommendations or references did he have? Just as these thoughts were going through his mind, he noticed quite by accident a huge poster that a sort of clown was carrying through the streets of Yokohama. The poster, written in English, read as follows. The Japanese acrobatics troupe of the Honorable William Battlecar, last performances, before their departure for the United States of America, of the Long Noses, Long Noses. Dedicated to the god Tengu. Great attraction.
The United States of America!
Exclaimed Passepartout.
That's right up my street!
He followed the sandwich man, and by doing so, soon found himself back in the Japanese quarter. 15 minutes later, he stopped in front of a large square building decorated on top with several garlands of streamers. On the outside wall was a painting, lacking all sense of perspective but with gaudy colours, showing a large group of jugglers. It was the establishment belonging to the Honorable Battlecar, an American showman, who was the director of a troupe of tumblers, jugglers, clowns, acrobats, tightrope walkers and gymnasts who, according to the poster, were giving their last performances before leaving the land of the rising sun for the United States. Passepartout entered the colonnade in front of the building and asked for Mr. Battlecar. Mr. Battlecar appeared in person.
"What do you want?"
he said to Passepartout, taking him at first for a native.
"Do you need a servant?"
asked Passepartout.
"A servant?"
exclaimed the showman, stroking the bushy grey beard under his chin.
"I've got two of them, obedient and trusty. They've never left me, and they work for nothing, provided I feed them. There they are,"
he added, pointing to his two sturdy arms, scored by veins as thick as the strings of a double bass.
"So I can't be of any use to you, can I?"
"None at all."
"Damn, it would have been really convenient for me to travel with you."
"Well, well," said the Honorable Battlecar. "If you're Japanese, then I'm a monkey. Why are you wearing that get-up?"
"You wear what you can get hold of."
"That's true. Are you French?"
"Yes, I am. A Parisian through and through."
"Well, in that case, you must know how to pull funny faces."
"Wait a minute,"
replied Passepartout, annoyed at this reaction to the discovery of his nationality.
"We French people may know how to make funny faces, but no more so than you Americans."
"Fair enough. Well, if I don't take you on as a servant, I can take you on as a clown. Do you understand, my dear fellow? In France, they use foreigners to make people laugh, and abroad they use Frenchmen."
"Oh!
Are you strong, by the way?"
"Especially after I've had a good meal."
"Can you sing?"
"Yes,"
answered Passepartout, who in the past had taken part in some street concerts.
"But can you sing upside down, spinning a top on the sole of your left foot and balancing a sword on the sole of your right foot?"
"You bet,"
replied Passepartout, with memories of the first tricks he'd performed in his youth coming back to him.
"That's what it's all about,"
said the Honourable Battlecar. The deal was done there and then. At last Passepartout had found himself a job. He'd been taken on as a dog's body in the famous Japanese troop. It was a bit demeaning, but it meant that within a week he would be on his way to San Francisco. The performance, loudly advertised by the Honourable Battlecar, was to begin at 3 o'clock, and soon the noisy instruments of a Japanese orchestra, drums and tam-tams, were blaring away at the door. Understandably, Passepartout hadn't been able to prepare for the performance, but he was supposed to lend the support of his sturdy shoulders to the famous act known as the Human Pyramid, performed by the Long Noses of the god Tengu. This great attraction was the climax of the whole show. By 3 o'clock, the audience had filled the huge building. Europeans and Asians, Chinese and Japanese, men, women and children rushed in to occupy the narrow benches and the boxes opposite the stage. The musicians had come inside, and the complete orchestra, with gongs, tam-tams, castanets, flutes, tambourines and bass drums, was playing away for all it was worth. It was the usual sort of acrobatic display, but it must be admitted that the Japanese have the best balancing acts in the world. One of the performers, equipped with his fan and small pieces of paper, gracefully imitated the movement of butterflies and flowers. Another, using the sweet-smelling smoke from his pipe, traced a rapid series of blue-coloured words in the air, spelling out compliments to the audience. Another juggled with lighted candles, which he extinguished one by one as they passed in front of his lips, and then relit one from the other without interrupting for a moment his wonderful feat of juggling. Another managed to make spinning tops perform the most amazing figures. In his hands, these whirring machines seemed to take on a life of their own in their unending gyrations. They ran along pipe stems, saber blades, and wires as thin as wisps of hair, which stretched from one side of the stage to the other. They went around the rims of large crystal vases, climbed up bamboo ladders, and then scattered to every corner, producing strange sound effects by the combination of their different tones. The jugglers juggled with them, and they spun in the air. They threw them up like shuttlecocks by means of wooden rackets, and they continued to spin. They stuffed them in their pockets, and when they took them out, the tops were still spinning, until the moment when, at the release of a spring, they burst out into a dazzling firework display. There is no need here to describe the astonishing acts performed by the acrobats and gymnasts of the troupe. The tricks they did with a ladder, pole, ball, barrels, etc., were carried out with remarkable precision. But the main attraction was the appearance of the Long Noses, an astonishing balancing act that has not yet been seen in Europe. The Long Noses made up a special corporation dedicated to the god Tengu. Dressed like heralds in the Middle Ages, they wore on their shoulders a magnificent pair of wings. But their most distinctive feature was a long nose, and in particular, the use they put it to. Their noses were made of bamboo and were about 5, 6, or even 10 feet long, some straight, others curved, some smooth, others knobbly. These firmly fixed appendages were in fact what they used for all their balancing acts. A dozen or so of these followers of Tengu lay on their backs and their companions sported themselves on their noses, which stuck up in the air like lightning conductors, leaping about and vaulting from one to the other, performing the most extraordinary tricks. The show was to end with a special performance of the Human Pyramid, in which about 50 long noses were supposed to represent the car of Juggernaut. But instead of forming this pyramid by standing on one another's shoulders, the Honourable Battlecar's artists were to be linked to one another only by their noses. As it happened, one of those who formed the base of the cart had left the troupe, and since all that was needed was to be strong and agile, Passepartout had been chosen to replace him. Admittedly, the dear fellow felt rather sorry for himself after putting on his medieval costume, decorated with multicoloured wings and a 6-foot-long nose that was fixed onto his face. It all reminded him too much of his youth, but in the end, this nose was his livelihood, so he put up with it. Passepartout came on stage and went to stand with the other performers who were to make the base of the car of Juggernaut. They all lay down on the floor with their noses pointing upwards. A second group of performers got into position on top of their long appendages. A third group formed another layer, then a fourth group, and with these noses that only touch one another at the ends, they built up a human structure that soon reached almost up to the ceiling of the theatre. By now, the applause was getting louder and louder, and the instruments in the orchestra were blasting out when suddenly the pyramid wobbled, lost its balance, one of the noses at the base disappeared, and the whole structure came tumbling down like a pack of cards. The cause of it all was Passepartout, who abandoned his post, got across the floodlights without even using his wings, climbed up to the right-hand gallery, and then threw himself down at the feet of someone in the audience, shouting,
"Oh, my master! My master!"
"Is it you?"
"Yes, it's me!"
"Well, in that case, let's get to the steamer, my fellow." Mr. Fogg, Mrs. Aouda, who was accompanying him, and Passepartout had rushed along the corridors and out of the building. But there they came upon a furious honourable battle car, who was asking for compensation for the breakage. Mr. Fogg calmed him down by stuffing some banknotes into his hand. And so, at 6:30, just when the ship was about to leave, Mr. Fogg and Mrs. Aouda set foot on the American steamer, followed by Passepartout with his wings on his back, and a 6-foot-long nose that he hadn't yet been able to remove from his face. Chapter 24, during which the crossing of the Pacific Ocean takes place. What had happened off Shanghai is easy to work out. The signals for the Tankadera had been spotted from the Yokohama steamer. Its captain, seeing the flag at half-mast, had made for the little schooner. A few moments later, Phileas Fogg paid for his voyage at the agreed rate, making the skipper, John Bunsby, richer to the tune of £550. Then the honourable gentleman, Mrs. Aouda, and Fix went on board the steamer, which immediately headed off in the direction of Nagasaki and Yokohama. After arriving that very morning, 14th of November, at the scheduled time, Phileas Fogg left Fix to his own business, went on board the Carnatic, and there learned, to the great joy of Mrs. Aouda, and perhaps to his own, though he didn't let it show, that the Frenchman, Passepartout, had in fact arrived in Yokohama the previous day. Phileas Fogg, who was due to leave again that very evening for San Francisco, at once set about looking for his servant. He turned in vain to the French and British consulates, and, after unsuccessfully going around the streets of Yokohama, he had almost given up hope of finding Passepartout when chance, or a sort of premonition, led him to the building of the honourable battle car. He would certainly not have recognised his servant in the bizarre attire of a herald, but the latter, as he was standing upside down, noticed his master in the gallery. He couldn't stop himself from moving his nose. Hence the loss of balance and all that followed. This is what Passepartout learned directly from Mrs. Aouda, who also told him how they had done the crossing from Hong Kong to Yokohama in the company of a man called Fix, on the schooner, the Tankadera. At the mention of the name Fix, Passepartout didn't bat an eyelid. He thought the moment had not yet come for him to tell his master what had transpired between the detective and himself. And so, in the version Passepartout gave of his adventures, he put all the blame on himself for having been overcome by the effects of opium in the smoking den in Hong Kong, for which he apologized. Mr. Fogg listened to this story impassively and made no reply. Then he gave his servant enough cash to buy some more suitable clothes on board. Sure enough, less than an hour later, once he had cut off his nose and clipped his wings, the trusty fellow had nothing about him of a follower of the god Tengu. The steamer that was doing the crossing from Yokohama to San Francisco belonged to the Pacific Mail Steam Company and was called the General Grant. It was a large paddle steamer weighing 2,500 tons, well-equipped and capable of high speed. A huge beam moved alternatively up and down above the deck. One end was fitted to a piston rod, and the other to a push rod, which, by converting rectilinear into circular motion, directly operated the wheel shaft. The General Grant had the rigging of a 3-masted schooner, and it had a great expanse of sail, which gave a considerable boost to its steam power. At a steady rate of 12 knots, the steamer should not take more than 21 days to cross the Pacific. Phileas Fogg could therefore confidently predict that after reaching San Francisco by the 2nd of December, he would be in New York by the 11th and London by the 20th, thereby beating the fateful deadline of the 21st of December by several hours. There were quite a few passengers on board the steamer. English people, a lot of Americans, a veritable flood of coolies emigrating to America, and a number of officers from the British Army in India who were using their leave to go around the world. During the crossing, there were no problems from a nautical point of view, because it was supported by its large paddles and steadied by its large expanse of sail. The steamer did not roll. The Pacific Ocean lived up to its name. Mr. Fogg, too, was as calm and as uncommunicative as usual, his young female companion increasingly experienced towards him feelings that went beyond gratitude. His silent nature, which was so generous in its own way, made more of an impression on her than she cared to admit, and it was almost against her own will that she began to give in to emotions to which the mysterious Mr. Fogg seemed quite impervious. In addition, Mrs. Ayuda was becoming extremely interested in the gentleman's plans. She worried about what could go wrong and threaten the success of the journey. She often talked to Passepartout, who was not unaware of Mrs. Ayuda's real feelings. The dear fellow now had total faith in his master. He never stopped praising the honesty, generosity, and selflessness of Phileas Fogg. Then he would reassure Mrs. Ayuda about the outcome of the journey, telling her repeatedly that the hardest part was already over, that they had left behind strange countries like China and Japan and were now returning to civilization, and finally that a train from San Francisco to New York and a transatlantic steamer from New York to London would undoubtedly enable them to complete this impossible journey around the world within the allotted time. 9 days after leaving Yokohama, Phileas Fogg had gone exactly halfway around the globe. So it was that on the 23rd of November, the General Grant reached the 180th meridian, the one which in the southern hemisphere stands at the antipodes of London. Of the 80 days he had available, it is true that Mr. Fogg had used up 52 and had only 28 left. But it should be remembered that if the gentleman was only halfway in terms of the difference of meridians, in reality he had completed more than 2/3 of his total journey. This was the result of all those enforced detours between London and Aden, between Aden and Bombay, between Calcutta and Singapore, and between Singapore and Yokohama. If he had followed all the way the 50th parallel, the one which runs through London, the distance would only have been about 12,000 miles, whereas Phileas Fogg was obliged by the vagaries of his means of transport to cover 26,000 miles, of which he had done about 17,500 by this date of the 23rd of November. But now the route was direct, and Fix was no longer around to put more obstacles in their way. Something also happened on this day of the 23rd of November that made Passepartout a very happy man. It will be remembered that the stubborn fellow had insisted on keeping London time on that famous family watch of his, since he thought that the time in all the countries he went through was wrong. On that particular day, then, although he hadn't put it forward or backward, his watch was in agreement with the ship's chronometers. It is quite understandable that Passepartout should have had such a feeling of triumph. He would dearly have loved to know what Fix would have made of this if he'd been around.
"What a load of nonsense this scoundrel talked about the meridians, the sun and the moon," Passepartout repeated. "Huh! If people like that had their way, we'd have some clever sorts of clocks and watches around. I knew for sure that one day or the other the sun would make up its mind to set itself by my watch."
What Passepartout didn't know was that if he'd had a watch with a 24-hour face, like Italian watches, he would have had no reason to be so triumphant, because the hands on his instrument would have shown 9 o'clock in the evening, that is the 21st hour since midnight, whereas the time on board was 9 o'clock in the morning. This was exactly the same difference as that between London time and the 180th meridian. But even supposing that Fix had been capable of explaining this scientific fact, Passepartout would almost certainly have been incapable, if not of understanding it, then at least of accepting it. And in any case, if, assuming the impossible, the police inspector had unexpectedly appeared on board, it is probable that a justifiably resentful Passepartout would have had something quite different to discuss with him, and would have gone about it in quite a different way. Where exactly, then, was Fix at that moment in time? Quite simply, he was on board the General Grant. What had happened was that after arriving in Yokohama, the detective left Mr. Fogg, expecting to meet up with him again later in the day, and went straight to the English consul's office. There at last he found the warrant that had been following him all the way from Bombay and that was already 40 days old. The warrant had been sent from Hong Kong via this same Carnatic, which Fogg was thought to be aboard.